What a pleasure it is and a privilege to be here with you tonight. And maybe we could go through a couple of slides here. Joel and I will try to synchronize here each other's. I'm not very good at Jedi mind tricks, so I am every now and then I'm going to have to say something to him. But maybe we could get the next slide here. There we are. So that's a little bit of my background, my education. Maybe we could go to the next one then. And these are some of the books that I have been writing or afflicting the world with, depending on your perspective. Let's move to the next one then. All right. That's a good place to start. I have two children. I have a daughter who is has finished college a couple of years ago, and I have a son who is at Baylor right now. Now, one evening a number of years ago, when my daughter was about two and my wife was pregnant with my son, I gave my wife a break. I took my daughter out to the mall. We went to her favorite place, the pet shop, and we went there because that's easier to get to than the zoo. You can get up closer to the animals. And while we were at the pet shop, one of the clerks was showing a small snake, a kind of python, to a couple of teenage boys. And these boys were sort of needling each other. Which of them was the more manly? Which of them had nerve enough to actually touch that snake with his own finger? And as these two boys were going back and forth, and neither of them really willing to reach out and get near that tiny snake, you'd think from the that they thought that it was more like the next slide from the way they were behaving. My daughter asked me quietly, "Can I pet the snake?" She reached up and she stroked it gently, and these boys were ashamed at being shown up by a toddler girl. Now, of course, I tell you that story because I'm a proud father, but I do have another reason for telling that story. I think it can be a kind of parable for the way that many Christians think about science. We fear it. I think, for there's three main reasons. First, most of us found science classes hard in school, and that's something that we have in common with everyone. Regardless of whether they share our Christian faith or not. The second reason touches on our faith more directly. We fear that science will somehow undermine our faith. And the fact that many writers who are hostile to Christianity, people like Richard Dawkins and Carl Sagan, will make just that point, only adds to the fear. Well, there's a third reason why I think we fear or at least dislike science. We're not really sure that it's good. We're not really sure that the world is worth the effort that it takes to study it well. Sometimes in Christian circles, we might say things like, "Well, the world is fallen, you know," without being careful just what we have a right to mean by those words. Other times, people will say, "Be careful, don't make an idol out of the world, don't love the creature too much." We're afraid that our love for the creature will displace our love for the Creator. We're not really sure, then, that this is God's world. Well, I think my daughter's interest in the python expresses true Christianity better than these common fears do. Her curiosity about this little wriggler, her delight in touching it, which is how she feels about just about any kind of animal, bugs. She's fascinated by bats these days, and she's doing tropical bat research. And if you ever have a bat in your house, all you need to do is call her, and she will remove it without harm to you or to the bat. But her stance towards any kind of animal is untainted by any kind of fear or misgivings. Well, I want to argue that the Christian faith provides us with the tools that we need to study the world and to do it with honesty, with zest, and with good discernment. I want to first show you that I think the Bible offers for us a worldview that calls Christians to love the world that God made, and then I want to show that this worldview also gives us four strong motivations for studying the world. And then finally, I want to show you that this worldview also supplies us with some cautions that will help us to think critically and carefully about what the sciences seem to be saying. But before I get started, maybe we could have the next slide here, make sure it's the one that I think it is. There's one thing that I can't do for you, not right now, is simply recount to you how modern science developed. That's a worthwhile topic, and I know a little bit about it, but I'm not by any stretch of the imagination an expert. You're probably aware that some people have tried to paint a picture of science being at war with religion, where in this way of telling the story, truth eventually wins out over fear and superstition. As a matter of fact, it was a few anti-religion people in the late 19th century who promoted this way of telling the story. It's called the warfare thesis. Historians of science nowadays don't hold that in very high regard. So I'm not going to go into that, but if there are questions about that during the Q&A, I'm happy to talk about such subjects. As I say, historians of science have discredited that and pretty thoroughly. As it turns out, much of what we know as modern science was developed by faithful Christian people living out their faith. As I say, I'm not enough of a specialist in the history of science to make any account of this kind worth your while. Besides, and this is actually the important point, people are actually pretty complicated in why they do the things that they do. They might have ideals, deeply held beliefs, and then act inconsistently with those ideals and beliefs. People with beliefs that you and I might count as bad, or at least badly defective, have nevertheless done really good things. And people who have cherished things that you and I might together cherish have nevertheless done really ugly things. Well, that's the main lesson that I would draw from this story, namely how complicated people are. And it's worth saying, but I'm not really going to spend much time on it any further, at least not in detail. Besides that, it would also be tempting to try to tell the story of modern science in a way that was implying to you that there is something that we can actually call modern science, and that it is uniformly good, and that anything that supports it is therefore good. But the historian Mark Kaltoff, I hope we've got Mark here on the slide. Yes, we have. He's written this. As a Christian, I'm not sure that I would be comfortable claiming responsibility for the rise of modern science. To be sure, it has offered many blessings to be thankful for, thankful to God, for all that is good comes ultimately from His hand. Yet human scientific knowledge of the world has not resulted in universal blessing. That's a good and helpful perspective, which we want to keep in mind. Besides that, it might actually surprise you to learn that it is beastly difficult to get a definition of science that everyone actually agrees on. And there's a good reason for that. In the next slide, I have a quotation from C.S. Lewis. Strictly speaking, he said, there is, I confess, no such thing as modern science. There are only particular sciences, all in a stage of rapid change and sometimes inconsistent with one another. There are sciences, each of them has its own subject matter and its own techniques. And that's why I think it's better to define the sciences this way with the next slide. A science is a discipline in which one studies features of the world around us and tries to describe his observations systematically and critically. Well, if we think of the sciences this way, we can remember that the sciences are carried out by scientists, that is, by human persons. Human persons who do things for very complicated reasons, as I mentioned already. So, if clear thinking is our goal, we're better off talking about what we should do if we take Christianity on board as fully as we can, and not necessarily what everybody has done, and so that's where I'm headed now. So we can go to the next slide. Let's begin by considering my first argument, namely that the Bible provides Christians with a worldview that calls us to love the world that God made. Yeah, oops. Of course, you and I have to agree on what we mean by the word worldview, don't we? Because there's no sort of central office for the English language that regulates how we use words. So I'm going to have to tell you what I think the word is useful if it means, and the way I'm going to use the word as I talk. When I use it, I'm talking about the basic stance towards God and others and the world that persons and communities hold. It's, if you like, it's how you lean into the world. We hold our worldview in our hearts, and so your worldview might not be the same as what you would articulate if somebody asked you, so tell me why you believe the things that you do. It's something that is held much deeper than that. but it's how your deepest self answers what Peter Kreft calls the three great questions. I think we need a good. Where did I come from? Why am I here? And where am I going? And a community instills its worldview by means of a big story, a story that tells a community where we came from, what went wrong, and what's been done about it, and whether that's been done by gods or by nature or by human beings or by some combination. Where are we now in this whole process and where the whole world is headed? The story helps the members of the community to take their place in the world, and it calls them to indwell the story, to believe this story, to see yourself as a player in how the story is going to unfold from here on out. If we go to the next slide, I have something from Steve Meyer. He is a thinker in the Discovery Institute, but I'm not going into his specific beliefs, but rather something that he wrote in the course of arguing for something. He said, many scientific theories have larger ideological, metaphysical, or religious implications. Origins theories in particular have such implications since they make claims about the causes that brought life or humankind or the universe into existence. Yes, certain scientific theories can matter a great deal because this is the first stage in the worldview story. Where did we come from? How did we get here? And so forth. Steve Meyer goes on to quote a leading neo-Darwinist philosopher of a generation ago, George Gaylord Simpson, who said this, "Man is the result of a purposeless and natural process that did not have him in mind. He was not planned." Now, what he's saying there is, in fact, a big story. If you believe that story, it will put your life into perspective. And if it's true, well, then the words of Macbeth on the next slide, when he learns that Lady Macbeth has committed suicide, sorry if that's a spoiler, but she does commit suicide in the play. And Macbeth says, "Life's a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing." And that is, in fact, a big story. That's inviting you to indwell that story and to live your life as a player in that kind of story. And, of course, it's telling you that it doesn't much matter how you play a part. It's all meaningless anyhow. Now, not everyone agrees that the biblical message brings a worldview with it, but I want you to see that it does by telling its own big story of the world. What does that story sound like? Well, there is one God who made humankind to know him, and he made a good world for human beings to live in, to rule over and to enjoy, so that they could love him and love one another. But Adam and Eve, the parents of all humankind, disobeyed God and set loose a power of evil in themselves and in all their descendants, a power that we observe all around us every day, and in fact, that we also observe within us, each and every one of us. But God never gave up on his creation. He chose this dude named Abram, who called him out at Ur of the Chaldees, to be a channel that he would use to heal all humankind. "In you, all the families of the earth will be blessed," God told Abram. And so Abram's family, who became Israel, were supposed to be an advertisement to all the rest of humanity of what it actually looks like when the maker of heaven and earth restores a people into their proper functioning so that they live like they were created to live. And the purpose that God had for setting up Israel as a nation in the first place was to put this on display for the whole world to see the love and the wisdom and the wholesomeness of the one true God. And the tragedy of most of the Old Testament is that most of the time, people didn't live that way. And so they were not much of an advertisement. In this context, you have the hope for a Messiah. The idea was that when he came to rule, he would lead the people finally in bringing light to the rest of the world. Well, Jesus came to fulfill this hope and not to overthrow it. By his death, he's paid for our sins, and by his resurrection, he has taken the throne of his ancestor David, and he's begun his rule. And we're here as a predominantly Gentile group. We have received his light, just as was his initial purpose in calling Abram. Well, there's more, of course, in this story. There might even be better ways of putting it, but the key thing for now is to realize that this story affirms that God is still in love with his creation and that he calls his people to love it as well. In the next slide, I have a quotation from Herman Bavinck, a Dutch theologian who died about 100 years ago. The essence of the Christian religion consists in this, that the creation of the Father, devastated by sin, is restored in the death of the Son of God and recreated by the Holy Spirit into a kingdom of God. Christianity does not introduce a single substantial foreign element into the creation. It creates no new cosmos, but rather makes the cosmos new. It restores what was corrupted by sin. It atones the guilty and cures what is sick, the wounded. It heals. Let's go on to the next slide. If I had time, I would argue that the Christian worldview makes a better home for science than any of the other worldview options that are on offer do. But for now, what I want simply to say is that everyone who really embraces the Christian faith should support the sciences wholeheartedly. The Christian worldview supplies us with four strong motives for loving science. I think we need the next slide there. And the first of these motives is to praise the Creator for His creativity. Genesis tells us that when God made the world, He kept looking at the stuff that He had made, and He saw that it was good. God made the world out of His own overflowing goodness. He has so much goodness that any one creature or multitudes of only one kind of creature wouldn't be enough to display all that goodness. If we go to the next slide, there are so many different elements, different compounds, different plant and animal types, different planets and stars, and the same God made them all to show forth His glory. To study just a little bit of this, knowing that the God who saved me in Christ is the one who made it all, enables me to honor Him more fully. In the next slide, we have a second motivation for the sciences. Namely, they allow Christians to enjoy God's goodness as we satisfy our curiosity. The world that God made has no end of really interesting things in it. There are birds and mountains and stars and so much more. Maybe we should have another slide here with something interesting on it. There are so many cool things in the world. How do these things work? How do birds fly? How do mountains rise? Why do stars glow? Curiosity is a part of the image of God. And yeah, we can get curious about sordid things, human evil and whatnot, but the world that God made is not a sordid place. Christians in recent times have been uncertain about whether the life of the mind is good or even tolerable, but this aversion is thoroughly unbiblical. On the next slide, in the third place, the sciences allow us to serve humankind. The sciences have helped us to harness the powers of nature for the sake of human good. Medicine is an obvious example of this, and the next slide will show you a particular medical example of a fetus being surgically repaired in utero, and I've actually met the young man who was being operated on in that particular picture. Of course, we've used these tools that we've developed to ruin others. But all that shows is that the natural sciences don't carry within themselves the ethics. We need dedicated Christians with hearts formed by Christian teaching to know how to apply their ethics as well as their intellects to the world that God made. Fourth, in the next slide, the sciences allow us to answer unbelief. I've mentioned already how some unbelievers use the tools of science to prove, as they think, a worldview that opposes the Christian one. As it turns out, a use like that is actually a misuse. But it takes some knowledge to be able to tell. I mean, who's going to help people evaluate these claims? Here's, in the next slide, here's something that C.S. Lewis once observed. He was asked to give a talk to a group of Oxford undergraduates. This was just at the very beginning of the Second World War. And Lewis was a teacher at Oxford. He served in the First World War. And in the early days of the Second World War, you had students at Oxford. You think about the age group, 18, 19-year-olds. They're wondering, ought they to be here studying? Should they not be at the front lines? Here's what Lewis told them. If all the world were Christian, it might not matter if all the world were uneducated. But as it is, a cultural life will exist outside the church, whether it exists inside or not. To be ignorant and simple now, Not to be able to meet the enemies on their own ground would be to throw down our weapons and to betray our uneducated brethren who have under God no defense but us against the intellectual attacks of the heathen. Good philosophy must exist if for no other reason, and he thought there were other reasons, but if for no other reason, because bad philosophy needs to be answered. The cool intellect must work not only against cool intellect on the other side, but against the muddy heathen mysticisms which deny intellect altogether. The learned life, he concluded, then, is for some a duty. Now, in my experience, Christians have stressed the last two of this list, namely to serve humankind and to answer unbelief, and have understressed the first two, namely to enjoy God's goodness and to explore things as we satisfy our curiosity, our God-given curiosity. But if we allow ourselves to undersell any of those four, we're actually going to lose some key facets of the image of God in us. The next slide. So I've stressed that the scientific study is a human activity and that it's a good in and of itself. At the same time, it is a human activity. And in light of the Christian worldview, that means that there are some cautions that we have to exercise if we want to be really good at critical thinking, which is another way of saying really good at thinking about the sciences. The first of these cautions is that we have to be aware of human limitations. You know, none of us can know everything. I've tried, and I'm almost there, but haven't quite attained it. And none of us can be right all the time. There was a time when I thought I was mistaken, but I was wrong about that. So, even, you know, never mind. I think the next slide. I'll give you an example. There was an evening a while back when my son was 8 or 9, and it was dinner time. And he asked for some salt on his vegetables. And my wife explained that she'd already salted them. But he didn't accept that. He couldn't see any salt on the veggies. And so he came up with a principle. If I can't see it, I can't taste it. Well, you don't assert a principle like that when both your parents are MIT graduates and think that you're going to be able to get away with it. So my wife proposed an experiment. She filled two glasses with water, and she mixed salt into one of them without showing my son which. And after it's been mixed, of course, they're both utterly clear. His job was to taste the two and say whether there was a difference. Well, I mean, you can tell where this is going. He took the fresh water just fine, and then he winced when he took the salt water. But the place where he really made me proud is when we asked him about his principle. Okay, so what do you think about this assertion, if I can't see it, I can't taste it? And he said, you proved me wrong. There you go. Now, that's the mind of a scientist. That's the mind of a good critical thinker. It's also humility in action. If you know anything about kids, you know that they can be willful. They won't let go of an idea even when they know that it's wrong. And if you know anything about adult scientists, you know that they can be willful as well. Our Christian worldview, if we really own it, promotes the kind of humility that we need if we're to think well about the sciences. A second way in which the Christian worldview provides us with the right kind of caution that we need is in its insistence that human beings ought to obey God, their Maker. And yet, because of the sin of our first parents, we at least find this obedience hard. Sometimes we find it downright unwelcome. That is to say, we recognize that there is such a thing as greed. There is such a thing as short-sightedness. There is actual evil. Take the case of stem cell research. One of my former students is married to a man who's actually pioneering successful treatments using adult stem cells. He won't use embryonic stem cells because of his Christian convictions. Many in the scientific establishment tell us that we must exploit these embryonic stem cells. Now, the issue right now is not whether stem cell treatments using embryonic cells hold any promise. So far as anybody can tell, they don't. It's the ones using adult stem cells that do hold the promise. But actually, there's an even more basic issue. That is to say, the embryo is one of us. It deserves, therefore, our respect and our protection, not exploitation. In the next slide, I have a quotation from Romano Guardini. He was an Italian, a professor of philosophy living in Germany during the Second World War, and after the war wrote a couple of very, very thoughtful works about ethics in the modern world. He said, "For the average sentiment," writing in 1956, "does anything at all remain that is still untouchable? When man drops the ethical reins, he places himself utterly at the mercy of power." He goes on to say, "To wield power that is neither determined by moral responsibility nor curbed by respect of persons results in the destruction of all that is human in the wielder himself." The Christian worldview shows us that that obedience to God actually exercises and preserves our humanity. And even if it may be tough to do this, we still must. Well, the third caution is related to the other two, only I've increased the intensity. Not only is there limitation and disobedience to God's commands, there is also human rebellion against God that will use anything, even God's own stuff that the sciences study, to keep God out. Now, I've said that people are really complicated, so I don't want to suggest that everyone who's not yet a Christian believer does this. And I don't want to imply that any scientific theory that we happen not to like does this either. But there are some that do, and we have to be on the lookout. Here's an example. I read a scientific paper in the Proceedings of the National Academy of the Sciences, in which the author, a retired botanist from the University of Pennsylvania, was elected to the National Academy in 2003, and he said this: "A belief in free will is akin to religious beliefs. Indeed, I would argue that free will makes logical sense as long as one has the luxury of the causal magic of religion. Neither religious beliefs nor a belief in free will comply with the laws of the physical world." In that article, he's arguing that all you really are is reducible to the chemicals that make up your body. In fact, he says that because of that, you do not have free will. And he says, I want to make it clear, I'm not saying that you don't have, that you have no more free will than a fruit fly. You have no more free will than a bowl of sugar. Now, there's a lot that I'd like to say about that, especially about how he's depriving himself of any chance of making sense of the world. What's fascinating is that he uses that as an argument for why people ought to reform the penal punishment system. He's sort of smuggling in an ought to do, which is highly ironic, given that he's just denied that doing things because you ought to do them has any meaning whatsoever. But the man is straight up telling you that he is making all kinds of very debatable assumptions about the laws of nature and about them being adequate to describe everything that you do and every motivation that you have. He's also protecting his own rejection of religion with his denial of free will, which is also a denial of moral responsibility. But the thing is, you don't have to follow him into his conclusions. You don't have to indwell that story. There's nothing about the sciences that require you to do that. You have to be able to recognize that he's using the sciences in a way that violates all the principles of good critical thinking. Many biologists will ridicule the idea of an actual Adam and Eve. They'll draw some evidence from the features of our DNA, say. Some Christian biologists are following this line of thinking, but see, that has a disastrous effect. Not only does it poison the Christian story, but because of that, it ruins our ability to make any sense of human experience. The story of Adam and Eve we'll talk about this in the second talk a little bit more in detail. It's about a couple of things. It's not primarily about two people and whether or not they existed, but it's an assertion that the human story begins, first of all, by something that God has done adding to the material processes that make up the world, by imposing the image of God on one of his creatures. It also means that human beings all come from the same source. We're all part of the same family. But it also means that something's gone wrong with the world, and that's something that's gone wrong can be traceable back to that source that we come from, not from God's creation, but rather from the rebellion on the part of these initial creatures. But that feeling that something's wrong with the world is a fundamental feature of human experience. J.R.R. Tolkien once wrote to a friend of his that we all yearn for Eden. He's right, we do. And the story of Adam and Eve is there to explain not only that we do, I mean, it didn't need explaining, but to give a name and a shape to that story, and also a hope that that yearning could actually be satisfied by what in the Bible is called redemption, by God's activity of recovering human beings to a proper relationship to himself, to one another, and to the world that he made. God is magnificent. His world is glorious and fascinating, and we honor him when we use all of our abilities to study what he's done. God has no fear that in that kind of study, we're going to uncover reasons for forsaking our faith, so long as we're being genuinely critical. And we don't need to fear either.